Welcome to Watershed Chats, a solution-centric mini-series of the Water People podcast. Here, we connect with folks who are transforming social and environmental challenges through their work and play for a healthy and habitable future on planet Ocean. This episode is supported by Patagonia, whose purpose-driven mission is to use business to save our home planet. I'm Lauren Hill, my co-host is Dave Rastovich, and today we're in conversation with psychologist and author Robin Grill, who has been in private practice as a psychotherapist, relationship counselor, and parent coach for 30 years. Robin is the author of two books, Parenting for a Peaceful World and Heart to Heart Parenting. Parenting for a Peaceful World, in particular, invites us to imagine a world where war, tyranny, human rights abuses, and ecological destruction are relics of the past. Robin dares to ask, what if the means to create such a reality were in the hands of mothers and fathers and all those involved in the care and education of children? By showing us how parenting customs have shaped both societies and major world events, Parenting for a Peaceful World reveals how children adapt to different parenting styles and how these early experiences underpin the adults we all become. Our podcast comes to you from the coastal land and waters of both the Bundjalung and Gubbi Gubbi nations. We'd like to acknowledge these traditional custodians and pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. We'd also like to extend that respect to all First Nations people this podcast ripples out toward. I'd love to start by, this is such a big question, but just talking about how we treat our children, whether they're our children or children that we engage with. What does that say about who we are as a culture?
What a great question. I'm going to pause for about half an hour and meditate on the answer for that one. Because when you say we, what does the way we parents say about our culture, and you're talking in the macro, in the cultural, not the individual. You know, the way that we parent as individuals has got a bunch of really interesting and powerful influences that I could come back to. But in terms of the culture, if I can put on my sort of anthropology hat, and I think deep anthropology, I really believe that there's like an intentionality in the way that collectively, customarily, we address childhood. I think it's purpose-driven, it's outcomes-driven, given what you think that you're needing to survive. And I don't think those choices are necessarily made very, very consciously, like a boardroom or committee around a table. But there's a kind of a almost an automatic that happens. And, you know, one of the kind of, I guess, very extreme examples are useful because they really illustrate a point. Like a very warlike culture that lives on the presumption of we're always going to be at war. And you can see that the child-rearing styles that to them feel the absolute assumption and the absolute normal, the absolute, why would you ever do it any other way? There is no other way, is a very violent, very obedience-oriented child-rearing mode. And that comes almost like second nature. You have children, of course you smack them. And it's very gender kind of driven, you know, with boys, you know, you're crying. You know, well, you're kidding, you're crying. I'll give you something to cry about. And so there's a great, great violence that when you're embedded in that culture, you don't see it as violent. You will not call it violent. You would not say this is abusive. This is what you do to children so that they can survive and then protect our community in this reality that we live in. And I guess that's one example. But then when you bring that principle home, and what does that say about us? You know, if you put out the premise that the way that we collectively raise our children is with some kind of a purpose in mind, look at what we do at school. We don't ask when children arrive in school, what do you really love? And if you don't know, you can try 12 different things for as long as it takes and you know, we'll see what you gravitate to. If you love surfing a lot, well, you're a surfing kind of person and let's see where that takes you. We don't trust children, we give them a thing to obey, an agenda to obey, and you don't get much of a choice until you're about 15. That's late in the educational game. by then, every day you've been thoroughly and methodically trained not to be in the flow. The moment you get into a flow, the bell rings, and you will be startled out of your experience and made to go. So it's coercion is what speaks in your ear all the way.
Mm.
There's a plan in that. That's about the industrial reality. You're not on this planet to live from passion and creativity and to make your own way and contribute from your heart. You're on this planet to follow, whether it's militaristically or industrially, a pattern that, you know, you're there according to what an industry needs. So you're fodder. And that's the unspoken. I'm interested not in what it says on the school brochure. I don't read the website because everyone says how child-centered they are, right? They all say you get the best view from here. They all say that.
Mm.
I'm interested in what happens on the ground. That tells me the intentionality, which is usually not that conscious. It's like what's been driven into our nervous systems that then becomes second nature.
It's an incredibly difficult paradigm to crack once it gets rolling, it seems like, the sort of industrialized educational paradigm. Our little boy is about to turn 4, and so we've been considering having school in our lives again and what that will look like and feel like. And I'm always struck by the way school discourages being in our bodies, listening to our bodies, our bodily urges, even using the toilet is the most crude example, but, you know, just people learning at different paces at different times in different ways. And
I really think that the school as we know it, what feels normal in the schools that I went to and most people I know went to, it's a systematic training to not listen to your internal rhythm. With every passing minute, you're distracted from your internal rhythm. And that's the witch that gets burnt on the stake. We're made to distrust that as if we're going to go antisocial and dysfunctional if we stay with our internal flow. And as is always the case with any of these almost religious, unconscious group collective beliefs, is that the truth is the opposite of what we thought.
Can you define flow for me in your coming from you? Because we in the surfing world and any sort of watery subcultures, flow is something that pops up in different ways for people, but there's a similarity to it. What does that mean for you?
Personally, I mean, it's the thing that I'm trying to reclaim in my life, you know, and I'm struggling to reclaim it. And when I have a moment of flow, I don't know it in the moment. Because by definition, once you start thinking, oh, look at that, I'm in flow now, this is really cool, you're way, way out of flow.
Yeah.
But I love those accidental moments when you set the conditions that invite flow and you disappear into it. And you wake up later on realizing that I've just been in a great state of flow. And great God Almighty, how I need more of that for my well-being and health and for the well-being and health of people around me as well. But it is, let me see, really... there's a sense in flow of, and I'm trying to define the undefinable, really. You put words to it, it impoverishes it straight away, but it's a bit of a hint to what it is. And there's a sense of loss of self-consciousness and complete absorption in what we're doing or being. So it can be in the doing of nothingness in, say, in a meditative state, or in surfing, you know, those moments where it's impossible to have a thought. And I think this is why surfing is addictive, because you don't make a lot of advanced decisions, right? Isn't that right? You're surfing at your best when you aren't there in one way. You aren't there in the usual sense. There's a bodily intentionality which is mostly surrendered to what the wave is that has been given to you. You have no choice over the wave. You just surrender to that shape and power and you sign your name on it. And you have no time. that's a state of flow. And you'll know you've been in a state of flow because your sense of time is being totally distorted. Mm. So you might think, wow, that was 5 minutes. And you look at your watch, you've been there for 2 hours. Yeah. And you get that lovely shock. You know, you gasp and you go, what? You're kidding me. And it can go the opposite way as well. Mm. You feel like you've been there all day long and 2 minutes have passed. It's really, so there's a timeless, there's a subjective timelessness. Mm. But such a focused absorption with what you're doing that there isn't a you in the ordinary sense. You know, for me it happens sometimes on a lucky day when I'm writing and I forget that I'm sitting down and writing. There's just a disappearing, like you die to the phrase that is dancing its way out of you, and it's delicious. And it's a different polarity to for me in writing, it's a different polarity to wild flow. You know, when you might be dancing or making a lot of noise and being musical. That's a kind of a silent, deeply silent pleasure.
Mm. Mm. You sound like a lifelong surfer when you're talking the way you were just talking about surfing and that dance. And I was just thinking about parenting and how the most wonderful moments for me in parenting are when we're just in that with our little boy.
Mm.
And that's pretty much like a daily focus. It is just like we're going to go down these stairs right here and walk into that flowing space right there and just be there and see what happens. And that he naturally pulls us into that current. And away you flow, like you just drift along from one tree to a bug to a part of the creek that's trickling to the cloud in the sky. And that to me just is like a peak parenting moment. It just all does, it feels like all of the roles, all the names, everything just drifts away and we're just all in that wonderful, soupy feeling. We're just there. And so I was just curious to hear what you have to say in relation to parenting in the flow, being in that experience with your children.
Oh, I mean, there's so much to say about that. That is what you're describing there is such a beautiful space to be in with our kids, so incredibly nourishing for the two of us. It's just deeply nourishing. And it doesn't look from the outside like there's all that much going on. But there's a state of being in each other's energy that is so satisfying and open to surprise. And I love that there's a third partner in that, which is nature, the third parent. Because when you go hanging without a purpose, you're not being burdened by purpose. That's another state, really, just hanging. And the surprises of the moment are what guide you if you make... Love is about creating the time and the space to let that happen and then just walk into it and there it is. You know, the right bug comes along to surprise you and make you say, wow. And then, you know, invariably this questions, you know, when your child starts being languaged, you know, the insatiable wanting to know that they have incredible scientists that they are. They want to know so much. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, you know, I don't want to make some kind of a holy grail out of flow. You know, the natural thing is we can't sustain it. We fall in and out of it.
Mm.
Part of being human is that we lose it and then we get cranky and we wonder, where did I leave it? Is it under the bed? What did I do with the flow? You know, how did I get that yesterday? It was working and today it's not working, you know. But some people will find it easier to sink into the pleasurable moments of togetherness in flow. I can tell you a workaholic won't. They'll find that torture, okay? Someone that's been in the corporate world in the city will find what you just described torturously difficult. But, you know, bringing flow to a state of conflict and challenge with our child in a moment of great tantrum or a moment of when they're frightened or a moment when they're in despair and crying, you know, their emotionality is always at 240 volts often. And we get so triggered, and then our own, this is the other side of parenting that's not just cultural but personal history.
Mm.
Our own personal histories and our own emotional wounds that we carry get triggered quite easily by our children and what they go through.
Mm.
How do we enter, how do we surrender to that? You know, one example of where we lose a state of flow is that, you know, we have this programming from our own histories, a lot of us, that emotion, wrong. Calm, good. Make child go to calm. You know, partly because I can't stand strong emotion, I get too triggered, and then I think the child is the problem. Or, you know, because I've been taught that, you know, I'm a bad parent if my child is going through a big intensity of emotion. What have I done wrong? It's one of those things. So to allow, to let them have their truth, their being, and to be in wonder about them, as well as about ourselves. Oh, gosh, look what's coming up for me when my child is screaming. I feel like screaming. You know, what is that in me that wants to scream? Just an equal sense of curiosity. And that invitation is a bit of a build it and they will come to flow. You build the soil for that, and flow tends to arrive and it opens up. That's about trust, really.
Mm.
Trust, and we've been taught not to, you know, not to trust that. I'm not saying that there aren't moments to guide and to set boundaries. That's a whole other conversation, to say no, to be teachers to our children. You know, there's all of that, of course, except right now we're talking about flow and where that's like a vital and essential ingredient of our well-being and connectedness too. And we've been taught not to trust those spaces, to let the storm come when there's a storm. The weather needs a storm. We need those storms in relationship. We even need those moments of conflict. There are growth states that happen when we're in conflict.
Hmm.
I don't mean violence. I mean just the conflict of interest that happens is 50% of our growth comes out of that.
Hmm. And it's so challenging when I mean, so much of your work, it's been speaking to me so deeply recently as Minnow has gotten older and he's growing into his own agency and will, and the rage that comes up for me in some of those tantrumy moments has just been unlike anything I've ever felt before. And to develop the awareness of that over time and to go, oh my gosh, I don't think I ever witnessed or experienced the holding of these moments in my life, in any of my relationships. I don't think I've ever come to rage, come to really deep conflict, not violence, just conflict, and then been able to resolve it in a relational way. I don't think I've ever had that opportunity. And so here, like, here's my call to both manage my own experience, lack of experience, total beginner's mind, and then also try to do better.
Well, I mean, I first of all, I think we need to have, we deserve to have truckloads of compassion for ourselves for the things that we find most difficult to manage in our parenting space, because in the same way that you wouldn't get, for instance, somebody that's barely learned to swim and you throw them in the sea and say, go for your life, the beach is that way. You know, you wouldn't throw somebody in an environment for which they've got no skills yet and no role modeling yet, completely out of the universe. And it's, I think that's a worthy metaphor for how it is for, I think, almost the entirety of our communities, that we haven't had good role models for how to ride the energy of rage in ourselves.
Mm.
For most people, it's almost unimaginable that rage is not violence, because the two have been paired so much that we've married them.
Mm.
If someone's angry, someone's going to get hurt. That's all we know from experience. And you see those images or feel them almost every day. You know, how can my rage be life-giving? You know, how can I make that energy safe but passionate and alive? That's, you know, a bit of a Mount Everest that we're all trying to find. And we were born with the ability for rage. I think if someone had taken a home movie of you when you were 2 years old, you'd see that in yourself. Sooner or later comes a moment that you want to scream at somebody. Yeah. And you did.
Yeah.
I did.
Mm. I'd love to backpedal a little bit, Robin, and ask you about what your personal experiences were, what the seeds of curiosity were that led you to start researching this massive book in Parenting for a Peaceful World.
I'm still coming to terms with what made me want to do that.
Yeah, because right, there's a lot of deep currents. So comprehensive. There's so much work in it. So much research, so much cross-cultural research.
I made a vow I'll never write a book like that again afterwards, because it was like it was prepared for me on the inside, and then the sheer volume, the enormity of what it ended up being in terms of looking in anthropology, in neuropsychology, in psychohistory, in psychology, psychotherapy, developmental psychology, and then synthesizing all of that into something that, like, I wouldn't forgive myself if I wrote something that is where you have to be really cerebral to read it, like an academic thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think boredom is a bit of a crime against humanity, so it needs to have a flow to it. So just string it all together and try to inject flow into it. But there was a lot to it, for sure. So I've been asking that question of myself. Why did I get that obsessed? And I do have a kind of a relentless thing inside me that I'm like a dog with a bone. I have to drill deep. I cannot rest with surface kind of causes for things. I'm insanely fascinated with where was this born? And I'm discovering that what drives that for me is that the moment where you find yourself going, aha, no wonder this happens. No wonder the crazy nightmare stuff happens, or the confusing stuff, or the bewildering stuff happens, that the frightening stuff. No wonder that happens. That moment of aha, no wonder, is so thrilling and so fulfilling that I have to go again and get another dose. So that's a huge driver for me, and that's part of what, you know, in terms of the personal side of that, I did grow up with a very, very shouty, out of control family. A lot of screaming, a lot of you know, people weren't really beating each other up like you hear a lot, but the screaming and the sort of the verbal abuse. And my father was just heavily, heavily traumatized from you know, Jewish in the Second World War. He didn't get taken to a camp, but, you know, he survived some absolutely terrifying things. He was like a ticking time bomb, and things would just, he sort of had Tourette's syndrome, where he was a great guy and then something would touch him off, one of his typical things, and he'd be screaming and for an hour. So I got shocked a lot. And I think my body learned to survive that by doing everything I can to see the storm coming so that I'm an anticipator, which is a good thing for some things, and it's not a good thing for when you're trying to let go and find flow, you know, to have that nervous system that's so kind of wired up for anticipating, you know, thinking through to the outcome. It's a way of being in control that is a safety mechanism, but it's difficult to find the switch to put it into off. But it means that part of that feels like a gift, that I'm driven to know the weather, what creates the weather in people, in not just individuals but in community and in the larger movements of people, society, country. And it's hard work, but it's so satisfying. as well. And I really, it was hard to write the book, but thrilling at the same time of making these discoveries, like life-altering discoveries, you know. For example, everyone gives me the impression that human beings are just so violent that we're always going to have the carrot and the stick somehow. Because if it wasn't for that, we're just one inch away from tearing each other to pieces and destroying the planet. And, you know, the only answer is that there needs to be a war so we don't get too overpopulated, all that really
the
dark
Darwinian paradigm.
That Darwinian paradigm.
Yes.
Of the dog-eat-dog world, which is incredibly, I mean, if you believe that, how do you get to sleep at night? Mm. And what are you thinking about your partner who's lying next to you, who's a member of this monstrous species, and what do you feel about yourself when you look in the mirror to whatever, brush your hair? And, you know, to discover that the enormous potentiality that we are and that what comes forth has got so much to do with, A, the environment that you're immersed in, but equally, or perhaps even more, the environment that your nervous system was steeping in childhood. And the childhood is the is where the programming is done that can be disentangled later, but it's hard work. So I feel like you want to know why we're so violent and we're wrecking the planet. When I researched, you know, what's been normal in the way that children got raised, what we now call severe child abuse, not long ago and for about 10,000 years in almost every civilization, that was normal, child raising. Then that's where I start to say, well, no wonder we behave the way we do. We're not only survivors of pretty severe childhood neglect and trauma, but if not, we're descendants of that. And you don't have far in history to go where we've had hell shown us by the people that love us, not by our enemies. So it's really like the hugest, duh. You do that to the human animal, how do you expect them to behave? And then someone has to invent a rule book and a religion and a morality, invent it, because loving behavior is not what's coming forth through our hands. We're survivors. We're collective survivors. That's, to me, okay, that's the best news I've ever heard when you think about it. Because what's possible? And what's possible is, I have every reason to believe that what's possible is quite a bit better than what we can imagine yet.
Yeah, and it's the magic of that flow as you get rid of that carrot and that stick.
Yeah.
And that outcome obsession on all those structures.
Yeah.
What's left is
our
feeling of connection to each other that will have us jump out of a car to save someone who's in a car crash and we know nothing about them. You know, we'll look after each other in those moments, you know, without a governing structure in our mind to make us do the loving and the right thing. We just do them.
The governing structure, which is like comparing Mount Everest to a pebble, the governing structure being Mount Everest, the pebble being their biblical rules for ethics, like, you know, there's a commandment to respect your parents, zero commandment about respecting your child. The governing structure is what's in your gut bacteria, in your gut brain, in your heart brain, in your brain, in your body memory of the love that you've received, the pleasure that nature has given you, the love that people have given you, that your body remembers every moment of that and has it in backup, warehoused. And that there's a trigger moment where you just can't help passing that on. You can't help it. And we're wired for empathy. We're actually wired. There's a lot of these brain centers that their design is to give us a bit of the feeling of the other people that we perceive. So that when you laugh, I mightn't even heard the joke and I start laughing and I don't know why, but I got the contagion of your laughter. That's an empathy moment. We wired for that. We got wiring for the potentiality of violence and the potentiality of immense love and pleasurable connection. And not just in rescuing somebody out of a fire, but in being wowed and curious about a stranger and sitting with the stranger in a bus stop and asking them about themselves and going, wow, I'm this incredible person today. That is the bedrock. That is the bedrock of, you know, the society that then gets built from that is completely discontinuous with the climate-wrecking, topsoil-destroying survivals of abuse that we are. Our society, our civilization is a symptom. People say, wow, we're descended from the ancient Greeks and Romans. Are you kidding me? That's where you want to be descended from? Those people, they did incredible things. They were also the most spectacularly misogynistic, warlike, horrifically child abusive. You know, that's who you want to be descended from in your cultural philosophy. Be worried about that. We want to honor that our history is trauma for the most part. A lot of beauty and art there as well, and inventiveness, but civilization is post-traumatic shock made into buildings and cars.
You've said that wounded children are running our world. I mean, that's what you're, that's what you're getting to, that all of us have inherited this trauma, and some of us get the opportunity to build an awareness of that trauma and try to untangle it. I feel like that's one of the gifts of parenting, and the deep, radically frustrating challenges is coming face to face with that trauma and going, why do I have this inclination? Why do I want to punch the wall? Why do I feel like I should leave a child in the next room to let them cry when their needs are to be with us? Why has that been our cultural tradition? Why do we feel like we need to break
our
those
children?
Deep human needs for connection?
Yeah.
How can we build trust if our goal from so early on is to break dependency, to break trust, and to break dependence? How did we get to that?
Well, if you can imagine the enormity of the crushing pressure on our spirit that brings us to that extremity of disconnectedness, right? It's a lot. It's not just whatever personal trauma we've experienced. It's civilizational. It's historical. And the day-in, day-out training. And when you have everyone in your life saying, you know, don't pick up that baby every time that he or she cries or they're going to never leave home. And the pressure of culture is gigantic. It's very hard to swim against that current.
Even when
people do it.
The reality is the opposite. The more connection you have, the more secure you are. And I sound really judgy right now. I totally understand with the crying example. Like, there are definitely times when you have to step away and take a moment for yourself,
you're going nuts.
Because you feel overwhelmed, and it's hard, it's challenging in those moments. But for me, it's just been incredible to go, okay, these are my culturally imposed boundaries. Am I going to step beyond them, or am I going to dutifully respect them? Now I get to choose.
Yeah, look, and one of the things that makes me feel so sad is that we usually or almost always talk of ourselves as parents as I, which sounds like such a lonely, unsupported place. So no wonder we even to be in that situation where your choice is, do I go crazy right now because I'm way past my empathy fatigue? All human beings will get empathy fatigue to the point that even if you're a saint, there's a point. If you can get driven beyond that edge of that cliff for yourself where you won't go to your own crying baby that you adore. You would take a bullet for that child. And on that day, life has depleted you so badly that there's no petrol left in the tank. So everyone is vulnerable to that. So I look at every parenting book and it talks about mum and dad, you know, and I think, hang on a minute. Snap out of that little hypnosis. Where's everybody else? Mm-hmm. Why were we there in the first place? The cruelty of having to make a choice, whether it's to your baby, it's either you or me, fella, because one of us has to not crack. And if I crack, then it's worse for you. So I'll leave you here while I walk around the block. You know, why are we in that situation in the first place? And, you know, the lie of the nuclear family and all of that, there's a history behind that, and that shouldn't be that way. And then anthropologists, and they do good work. These days they do really good work. God, I admire that profession. They're methodical. Mm. And together with archaeologists, what they found, to get to the punchline, is it's four people per child. Mm. One child, four people. Two children, eight people, eight adults. Now that throughout most of human history, that's what was required. We're not designed for two parents, one child. If you... two parents, one child, you're outgunned and outnumbered by that one child because their emotional need is far more than what you can bring to the table.
I can say, by definition, it feels fundamentally unnatural.
Yeah.
To be isolated and away from the context of many hands and many emotional bodies to support you in parenthood. But how do we, so as modern people with pre-modern wirings for these communal, collaborative parenting setups, how do we do parenting?
Do you know, the best thing you can possibly do, and this is an answer probably to every question, begin by realizing that our culture and what feels normal to us is a tiny little option, right, in a gigantic library of options. So we are very, very weird. And up until we just that moment where you realize, I'm weird. A lot of what I think, a lot of my kind of automatic reactions are just weird. That's what's great about traveling or being amongst people that come from a culture that's very, very, very different. You know, jump out of this city or the kind of near city or the Australian scape, hang out with Indonesians or not city Indonesians, pre-modern, you know, or a New Guinean. Have somebody look at you and say, what a weird creature. Why are you white people always so cranky and exhausted around your kids? What has been done to you? And the impact of having that said to you was said to me once. The impact. And at first you feel this wonderful moment of shame. Like, I must look so stupid. And we've had everyone I love and know looks so stupid to this person. And I said to that particular person, so what, don't you guys get, she goes, no, we don't get tired around our babies. Because if I even look close to being tired, my mum is within earshot and she'll come racing up like a shot. She says, time for your rest. Give me your baby. And it's a natural kind of a tag team or a friend or a dad or, you know, just whoever, auntie. So there's a web of people, you know. We got so lost in that gear of being separate individuals that we're very, very, very good at, I think. I think we've developed that to a gift, but we got stuck in that gear and the clutch is broken. We don't know how to go into the other gears of being us. We don't know how to be an us very well. I remember noticing when my daughter was a primary school age and she went to a little bush school on the edge of a national park, and it was all the kids went barefoot all day and there was animals coming through the school and there was a python in the classroom living in the ceiling, and it was democratic run and parent run, community run. So there was a constancy of like a net of people, a web, and even the younger kids would adore looking after a baby. So if a baby goes the slightest grizzle, there'll be three pairs of hands moving towards that baby. And any little conflict, then there'd be two adults coming in. And not just looking after your own kids, but there's an organic movement amongst people where everybody's social needs are, you're in a state of your needs being met. You know, you're only a tiny short umbilicus away from the placenta of the crowd, in a way. And there was, I noticed one day I kind of woke up in the middle of that dream and became an observer of it. And I remember that moment. The first thing I noticed is the kids here are unseasonably content. This is not what you see in all of the other spaces. You go to a shopping mall, you always see somebody having a tantrum, you always see somebody make a horrible threat to their child or completely ignoring their child. Here there's a contentment. The tantrums are very, they're shorter, they're smaller, and they're few and far between. Because we're in that, the kind of like a placenta of connectedness. And when you want to be alone, go in the bush, be away from people, and you're connected to self and earth and in your silence. And that's a different flavor of bliss. And I noticed that. And I thought, this is the bedrock, and this is what we've dismantled. And what we think as a child is not like how a child is designed to be, because we've lost the villageness of being, which it really, frankly, was not hard at all to create. What's hard is to create the sort of the sanitized synthetic structures and boxy places that we put our kids in now. That's hard work. This was less hard work. We had classrooms where, I remember one particular day, another example, there was a moment where a teacher had an accident or got sick, I forgot what it was, couldn't come to school and announced it very, very late, and it was too late. They were frantically trying to get a substitute. Couldn't get one, which is a wee bit, you know, dodgy in terms of insurance or whatever, but the older kids got left in their classroom without adult supervision for the best part of the day. The administrator, you know, in her bare feet was, you know, sprinting from place to place trying to do her gig and checking in on the kids and making sure that everything's okay and juggling. And it was an odd day. And I remember the sense of a visiting parent coming in and walking into the classroom and seeing all these unsupervised primary school kids working peacefully and helping each other and having a real – and learning and studying. And if you'd lived in that, that's your baseline. You don't remark upon it because it's normal. And these visiting people were in a state of kind of benign shock. First of all, why isn't there an adult in here? Ooh, that's embarrassing. We had a problem. Secondly, why aren't the kids at each other's throats? Why aren't they vandalizing? And why are they learning stuff? They're actually studying. They're giving themselves work. What, you know, what? Yeah. So you can find implications out of that. But I love that sense of how weird we are. Because it's a little embarrassing at first, then you go, but this is exciting. You know, there's an incredibly high ceiling yet of who we can be, that we can grow into for not much money, actually, frankly, not that much effort. You know, we and you don't necessarily have to do years of therapy. You know, that's one wonderful path to take, but it's not the only. You know, comes back to flow. When, if you're fortunate enough that the life has supported you to choose things that bring you into flow states, whether it's your vocation, the work that you do, or the surfing, or all of the above, immersing ourselves in their flow environments, whatever is naturally a flow to you is different than what makes you flow and whatever. The immersion in their flow states and in our good connections with people, when we can be emotionally open with one another at least a little bit, you know, that is immensely powerful at bringing out, bringing forward the parts of us that are most wise and able to connect and trusting and contributive and generous. So there's just, I'm not even near discovering all the different things that are very therapeutic, right?
Robin, there's something that there's an aspect of the surfing world which we're deeply a part of, and a lot of people who listen to what we do are from that world. There's an aspect of surfing as escape. There is it's unique for everyone what surfing is, and it's always changing. Some days you go to the beach and you ride waves just to get the physical activity. Other times it's a deeply mystical experience.
Yeah.
It's always changing. But there is a pretty common thread through the culture around the world of it being semi-escapist, and our media, our magazines, our websites, all that stuff pitch it that way. You know, you get away from it all, you go catch a wave. So I know that for us and probably many other surfers, when we are being stretched as parents or stretched by a situation in our community where we are playing out sort of automated habits that have come from our childhood, but we don't want to, then we feel guilty, then we feel overwhelmed, and then we just want to go surf to try and get away from it all, get some clarity. What would you say about that kind of approach, that we will go, oh man, Lauren, like I will say that to you, I'm like, like when I've cleaned the house and I've done all these domestic things, I'm just like, I need to go surfing, I need to go into a wild space, and I've got to get out of here. But it's not really that healthy. It's more of a running away than a facing sometimes. What would you say to those of us who go towards the ocean or towards those pursuits in that sort of escapist way? Like what can we do in those moments that's a better version of ourselves so that we can stay with what's happening rather than running away?
Gosh, there's probably so many things that can be said about that, and there should be said about that. And I'll only kind of come to whatever it is that I can think of in this moment. But one of the things that occurs to me is that the value of your relationship to going to the surf when you're suspecting that you're escaping, the value, you could try this as a kind of an experiment. What is it that you come back to the dry land with afterwards that might show you, you know, you put the pause, you press the pause button. And I think that there's, we do get in the kind of the pop psychology, new age culture, we get punished a lot. We punish each other a lot for having an escape, probably because escape is overused to toxic and addictive levels. But if we don't have a place of the pause button at all that we can really forgive ourselves for, then we suffocate and get violent. And so we do need to have a lot of forgiveness and like wiggle room. And maybe if you feel like you want to escape, then call it that and escape 100%. You know, I'm escaping the conflict. I've got no answer for it today, too much. I'm sitting on my board escaping, okay? I'll be that. Be that. And there'll be the consequences that you come back to barefoot on the soil later on. You know, I guess when it's habitual and it doesn't change to something else, you know, then the surfing potentially is a bit like smoking weed, you know. Everything is still, you're running on the spot. Everything is still there waiting for you to grow up, you know, when you get back on land. So the consequences will tell you afterwards. I think escaping is good. Overuse of escape means that we are not developing a new resource and strength that we need. And that's not a reason to smack ourselves on the wrist, you know. That self-punishment is patriarchal civilization 101. Punish yourself, because that's the way that it works. Mm. But to say, look, obviously I need some support, whether it's, you know, male support, female support, non-binary support, I don't know, group support. There's a muscle I need to develop about facing some particular issues. Mm. It feels overwhelming. What help do I deserve in this? Mentorship, whatever.
Mm. There's a real quality after the escapism that is sort of the proof of the value of it, I guess.
And we know
I know that,
that
from my parents, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, from my own experience too, but just thinking about my relationship with my own parents, I can feel that.
We often talk about it too, just like how, with each other and with other friends, how, oh, I'm a way better partner after I've had a surf.
Yeah.
Or, oh, I can parent presently.
Yeah.
When I've gone to the water and just had that pause. But there has, you're exactly right, there is an echoing voice around surfing being this selfish thing that we do. And just fitting that into parenting lives in an appropriate way is really beautiful to see in our friends and in ourselves. It makes it a meaningful pursuit, like we always say, meaningful play.
I think, you know, what you're saying reminds me that our relationship to a thing is what makes it. So I'm sure that you can be just totally narcissistic or the complete opposite, where that's where you learn your humility, your deepest humility, because it's an environment that you have no impact on at all. You're at your most useless. When you're on this land, you can grow a garden. When you're out there, you've got no say over what happens other than in your own body and how you ride a particular wave or miss it or which one you wait for and all of that. So I actually love the humility that it has the potential to cultivate, if that's the sort of the door that you open in your mind when you go out. So, you know, I guess anything can be a poison or a weapon or a tool of enlightenment, depending on our attitude. I actually think I find myself using – I'm not much of a surfer, by the way. I have to – my disclaimer is I play on a boogie board, and that's about as far as I go. I've always lived by the surf. But I find myself using the metaphor of surf more and more and more and more and more with my writing, and the older I get and I find myself wanting to talk about it, I find myself increasingly inspired by the fact of so many things that it gives, like an opportunity to be very, very aggressive, but nobody gets hurt. You know, when you have a lot of built-up charge in your body and this frustration, and you can paddle hard and you can, out there, you can swear at the waves or you can roar and you can roar with the ocean, and but you're not hurting anyone. Or hopefully not yourself either. But also that sense of the deep humility that you don't get a say over the wave or when it comes or its shape or whatever, but you get a moment of eternity where you sign your name on it and then it's gone forever and nobody saw you do it, probably. So what can make you more humble than that? It's gone. It's like the Buddhists make the mandala and then it's swept away. You know, their artwork.
Yeah.
What you did on the wave is gone forever. You'll never do it the same way twice. And you might be feeling like, oh, that was great. But it's gone. Didn't serve anyone.
Yeah.
I'm very moved by that, actually. And I think that there's in that an attitude to cultivate in ourselves that is essential for where we are on the planet right now, because most of our technology is about domination. The embedded instinct is dominate nature, win over it. That's who we think we are. So we're at death's door, okay? We're a minute from midnight because of that. And there is a flip side culture, which is about partnership with nature, like regenerative agriculture, circular economy, renewable energy.
Collaboration, isn't it?
It's all about collaboration, giving into the energy that's there. And riding it like a wave.
Yeah.
That's the surfer's attitude to industry, productivity, technology, civilization. Very different.
Yeah. A major theme that's come up on the podcast so far this season is about colonialism and its relationship to surfing and surf culture. I wonder, what's the relationship that you've seen between colonialism and parenting? Sort of taking that power over paradigm into the home. Is that what's been guiding us in your research?
For sure. There's you know, the way that we've been treated, unless there's some kind of a consciousness-raising exercise that you go through in your life, the way that we've been treated becomes how we then treat our children, how we treat other people, and how we treat the earth, how we treat the non-human world.
That's so profound. It's profound.
How you treat it is how you treat, and how you treat yourself as well.
Mm.
So we colonize our children.
Mm.
That's what we're doing in schools. We put immense devotion and determination and doggedness into interrupting them being themselves. Right? It's a one-way thing, top down. We fill them like empty bags with the knowledge that we select for them. And it's knowledge. Yeah. It's not how to create.
I mean, that's what that's to a large part what we've been taught parenting is as well, that our children are to be shaped and molded into someone for us to be proud of, for them to fulfill our own expectations of
like
success.
Trophies.
And having nothing to do with the actual person.
The narcissism in that is cosmic in proportion.
Mm.
So, you know, the idea that the child brings pride to you or brings shame to you as the sort of the, you know, the little hood ornament at the front of the car.
Mm.
And there's a sense of property on the child, and that's a deeply colonial thing. But we've been colonized. It's the colonized.
All of us.
Are the colonizers.
Mm.
We've been treated like property.
Mm.
We think in property.
Mm.
We've been owned. You know that angry retort that this is my child and I'll treat my child the way I want to, and how dare you presume, and that's my child, my... Well, yes, your child, but that doesn't mean property. This is my land. That doesn't mean I'm going to turn... I don't have the right to turn my land into concrete. What I do to this land will affect someone in Brazil, in Nepal, in... Right? So... Mm.
And that's the idea of reciprocal relationship instead of top-down
relationship.
Relationship
rather than dominion.
Yeah.
So the energy of colonization is just a face of that sense of ownership. And when that's the only impulse that we understand, because that's how we've been raised and how our forebears have been raised, this is 10,000 years of property deals, is what.
Why 10,000 years?
Because it's not that there was never violence.
Yeah.
There always has been. You know, people get pushed hard enough, you know, and stuff happens. But the degree of violence and the level of organized violence and the level of unrestricted, unrestrained butchery, and the worst kind of violence, which is slavery.
Mm.
That began when we became, when this thing that we call civilization, when we started growing our food out of an ecology. So we've always been monocroppers. We trained ourselves to be users. Mm. So an animal is the thing that's going to pull the plow. We've been at that for 10,000 years. That's when slavery began. That's when organized war began. That's when infectious diseases began. They're all zoonotic. They come from ripping animals out of their ecology and shoving them all together in this completely unnatural, you know, mono species. So we have been in a world war. There's only ever been one world war. But it's been going for 10,000 years. It never stopped. There aren't days of peace in between. World war is that we've declared war. We've been warring against ecology, systemic, the health of, health comes from diversity. That's when things balance up. Every disease comes when you monocrop, when you rip things out of ecology. Okay, that's been our reality for 10,000 years. We got sicker, shorter, tooth decay, plagues, war, slavery, all of the nightmares of the history books pretty much began with civilization as we know it. And yet, it's not about going back to a cave-like existence at all. You know, there's actually a lot more prosperity that comes out of, you know, you know this better than I do now, that growing, instead of growing a crop, growing an ecology, right? That's what permaculture does. That's what regenerative agriculture does.
Mm.
You know, mixing animals. If you like eating meat, then enjoy it, but have animals that are together, interspecies, and having a pleasurable life, which is, it's not just a different technique. That is a different mindset all the way down to your deepest thought and impulse. That's no longer about entitlement, where we're not using anymore. Not colonizing the soil. We're in love with the soil. You know, regenerative agriculture, your soil profile builds and it becomes more diverse in the microbiome, just to say what you've already heard 1,000 times. That's a love story and it's mutual. There's no taking that happens without giving. So the mindset of entitlement doesn't fit into that mold anymore. So that's why I think colonization is not this thing where Europeans go and conquer Africa and South America. It's this. It's always been colonization of children, of each other. It's been that for 10,000 years. Mm. And we're still at it.
In your work and your experience, what can we use as antidote to that colonial approach, perspective, experience?
Tons. Everything that is not that. Everything that's about mutuality, everything that's, you know, you understand surfing better than anyone and the surfer's attitude to how we do things. You don't sit there proclaiming what bloody wave is going to come next. You listen. You go very quiet and you watch and you go into a very dynamic state of listening and bringing that state of flow into everything that we do, you know, watching our garden. What are the species that love it here? You know, what attracts the birds that the plants like to have around for balancing the, you know, the bugs? And there's a lot of watching involved in that. And that's a loving way to live because you're not alone anymore.
Mm.
When you're dominant, you're the only person that counts.
Mm.
When you're not entitled anymore, you're not the king shit that rules over everything. Well, maybe that's not a buzz anymore and an ego rush, but you're surrounded by family. Life is family. You know, the trees are all beings, the council of beings are, we work with each other. There's a aloneness starts to dissipate. That's so nourishing and life-sustaining. So already that starts to change our manner of being with our kids.
Mm.
You know, we're less triggered.
Mm.
We're less triggered. We're less reactive. We're more curious. It's not about raising a child so much with an idea of who you want them to be when they grow up. This might be a final moment. So about being curious about them and asking them questions. Mm. How do you feel about this? What do you think next? That's the reversal of where we've been.
Yeah.
And good things flow from that.
Mm.
Even the right technologies and production systems and the way of making cars and streets differently flows out of that state. And it's also healing, okay, for the shock that we carry.
I love that you've said that you don't believe in parenting experts and you don't consider yourself one because of the way parenting has and continues to change so radically and is such a reflection of social evolution, really. I think it's it can be seen as quite a beacon of how quickly we can change. Does it feel that way to you? I mean, I feel like parenting paradigms, when I think about the way I was treated, the way my dad was treated, it's very different than the way we treat our son, not perfectly by any means, but the questions get turned over really quickly.
Yeah.
Or they can in the home. Do you see it as a, do you see the trajectory of how we treat our children as a positive one?
Mostly. There are some things that I'm really worried about that are getting worse.
Mm.
In a very quick nutshell, what children are being fed is catastrophic.
Mm.
The screens that are doing the parenting, the screen is the village. And, you know, I like a bit of screen. I'm happy with my computer, you know. I love that.
Yeah.
That you can Google whatever you want, but it's harmful. It's messing with attentional centers in the brain. So you know, things like that are definitely going backwards.
Mm.
But there's a lot of things that are improving very, very, very rapidly.
Mm.
There's a huge trend around most of the world to take violence out of parenting. I'm not saying we're there yet by a very, very long shot, but the trend is rapid in historical terms.
Mm.
It's very widespread and going in a good direction.
I'd love for you to speak to the specific instance of hitting children, a smack. Why not smack your kid? I'd love to know what your sort of holistic psychologist's perspective is. What do we teach our children when we hit them?
Well, what did we learn by being smacked? What do we remember about the moment of how it felt and not what you are being taught to think about it? Because quite often the response to that is, well, I deserved it because I was a brat.
Mm.
So, you know, you're not seeing yourself from the inside there. You're seeing what an adult fed you about yourself.
Mm.
I know you were a brat. No healthy child lacks moments of selfishness and narcissism by definition, right? Wild beings. But what did we learn from that? I remember I wasn't hit much. There was other issues in my family, but I remember the shock, the stunning shock, the feeling of complete betrayal. You know, the hours of disbelief, like, what? This is my father? And I just just became his punching bag.
Mm.
And I didn't come back from that.
Mm.
What I learned is to hate him. I also learned shame. You know, there's nothing moral that came out of that. I did learn to duck. And that's what morality is. Morality is when you do what's expected of you while people are watching.
Mm.
Morality is don't get caught.
Mm.
It's not behaving lovingly because that's what comes from inside my body. It's I'm going to do this because I get the points. It is a massive kind of fraud that we do to survive. So that's all the things that we learn. So what's the point?
Mm.
What is the point? You know, I won't even enter the idea of it's traumatic and all of that. That's for another day.
Yeah.
What is the point of having kids that so-called, can you do quotation marks?
Yes,
on,
we can.
You know, giant quotation marks, well-behaved, not because it comes out of I care about you right now. It's like this is what I do so you're not going to hit me again and I get my ice cream. You know, how do we settle for that? That's one take on it.
Mm.
And, you know, if it's okay to smack your kid, then I never want to hear you complain about domestic violence or wife abuse. Don't you dare, not in front of me.
Mm.
If you can smack a child, you can smack your partner. Mm. You know, if you can explain to me why a child who's about a quarter your size, about 4,000 times more vulnerable than you are, are less resourced than you are. Well, that's not domestic violence. Mm. But tapping your partner on the wrist is. Yeah. Find a mathematics to explain that and I'll give you a medal.
Well, domestic violence is still quite an epidemic.
I don't know how it can't be. How wouldn't it be an epidemic? Because what is normal is to hit children. If you go back not very long. Mm-hmm. I'm old enough to have been caned in school.
Yeah, likewise. I reckon probably the last generation at schools, most schools.
Yeah.
Just so recent.
Yeah.
Well, then how do you learn to transform that modeled behavior?
By replacing it. By filling yourself up with things that are that work and that feel more fulfilling and satisfying. Mm. You know, your body is limited in size. There's not enough room for every kind of tradition to live in there.
Yeah.
And you'll still have, because we're human, and when we get provoked past a certain point, there's that thing that happens in your arm when you make a fist. Mm. There's that little moment, I'm going to smack that kid or that other person. All human beings have that. We constantly have that as a little flash, you know, when someone rips you off or whatever it is where you want to hit, but you also have much larger impulses to care and to not repress yourself, but to hold that impulse in your hands and become assertive instead of violent.
Mm.
Right, so that builds like a muscle.
Mm-hmm.
You go to assertiveness gym by using your personal power instead of, and that's a practice. You don't learn that from a weekend workshop and it's all done.
Mm.
It's a daily practice of using our personal power rather than hitting is when you're at your weakest point. It's the most powerless thing to do, although it might feel tough in the moment. But you've just lost all credibility and lost all loyalty from those that you strike. You've killed your team in that moment. So it is a practice. It's very learnable.
Mm.
And we learn in the community. We learn best in community. When we're at the receiving end of kindness, when we're at the receiving end of friendship and inclusion, and it's a empowering, a softening agent on our hearts that then conditions us to behave differently towards our children.
Mm.
You know, you start to find that it takes a lot more to really push you off the edge.
Mm.
You get takes more to trigger you.
Mm.
The impulses that come into your arms are kind of different.
I grew up in a single parent home with my mom, and we have quite a few friends. I guess it's a stage of life right now who are going through divorces, breakups. And I had quite a few people reach out to me when I put the call out that we were going to sit and get to have this conversation with you. I had people reach out who are single parents wanting to know if you have any advice or resources for parents who aspire to this sort of communal shared parenting situation but who are going at it alone. How can we do that better? How can they do that better?
Together. And I know that that's easy to say and that most of us, because we come from single parent or nuclear family realities and we come from massive kind of training that don't ask for help and, you know, being independent is good, being dependent is bad, all of that, there's an immense amount of learned shame about wanting to be together and wanting support. Incredible shame about that. So that when I say we need to not be alone and do single parenting in a group, in a community, I don't want to say that in a glib way, just jolly well go out and do it. For some people it's easy. For some people there are kind of embarrassment hurdles to jump and who do you trust? And my mother's group didn't work out. That person got hostile. You know, all those kinds of stories. And doing our best, I guess.
Yeah.
I tell you what, those cockatoos are one of the big reasons why I came back to Australia and decided I'm not going to live in New Zealand, I'll live here. Because the bird life in this country is it just
is. Yeah.
Keeps me sane.
It brings you back.
Oh, I love it.
Every moment.
My favourite.
Mm. I think of power when I hear you say that, Robin. Mm. I think about like the dynamic we have going on at the moment where we're very fortunate to live on a parcel of land that can accommodate a couple families and even a couple aunties and uncles as well. And that's what we have going on here right now. And so awesome. there are three children under seven, and there's like five adults, and we're all oscillating around each other, picking each other up when we need it, helping each other have space when we need it. But there's also these little points that pop up occasionally, and I'm sure if you're a single parent, they pop up a lot, where you are confronted with a moment where you won't have control over the situation that your child is in and how they're going to be treated in situations when that your child is with an auntie or an uncle or a friend or whatever. So there's inevitably going to be these moments where there's a letting go and there's a trusting of some sort that happens. Is that a major hurdle for a lot of us?
It's one of the majorest.
Yeah.
It's one of the ones that I hear the most, particularly with older generation, like grandparents or the old auntie and whatever, that, you know, you're spoiling that child or, you know, you're not giving that child enough discipline or whatever the old story is that we're trying to break away from. And, you know, there isn't value in the older generation, huge value in the older generation and wisdom, but there are often those moments of fundamental conflict about we're trying to learn how to do things differently and that it's you're wanting to rely on the village, but what happens when realistically the village treats your child in a way that you just don't want? And it's a hurdle. And if I had absolute answers for that, I'd also have absolute answers for, you know, climate change and time travel or something, you know.
We just don't have time to go into it. Sure,
that's
the tune in for the next second
episode. I mean, I want to say, on the one hand, really acknowledge the difficulties and the hurdles, not just accept that it has to be that way, but to keep on asking the world and ask ourselves, what's my resource for that? Who can help me? What's a new thing I might be able to learn? Do I need to get away from that person? Do I need to just learn how to set better boundaries or learn how to negotiate? Is maybe my child going to be okay because the world has all kinds of people?
Mm-hmm.
But it's worthwhile learning. Everyone's got a different temper and different sense of boundary, and that I'm the bedrock that they come back to. If they didn't like how Auntie treated them, what makes the difference is the conversation that we can have about that afterwards, you know, that validates them.
Mm.
I mean, if you're worried about other people, don't let your child go to school, because guaranteed there's going to be the classroom bully. Sometimes the teacher will be a bully, absolute guarantee, or somebody that will, you know, break their heart because I don't want to play with you anymore. You can't be in my group. That will happen. It's a case of not if but when. So the thing that makes ultimately the difference isn't the lack of getting hurt in the world, but it's, do I have a home base that I can talk to about it? If I can cry on your shoulder, if I can tell you my truth, if I can say I hate the world today and I'm angry or I'm hurt and you validate me, I'm okay with the hurt.
Mm.
I come home to me again.
Mm.
And that gives us a lot of freedom to move. And we need that because every village is filled with imperfections. So that's important to get, the conversations we have about it afterwards.
Mm.
You know, trauma is not in the bad stuff that happens. It's in the lack of dialogue afterwards. That's where the trauma begins. Kids can live through horrible stuff if they can rage or weep about it afterwards to a trusted person. So, it's not only what single parents can do, it's what can we do for single parents when, you know, shouldn't we all be hanging out with them or something or inviting them over or I don't know what. Let me help you push the pram through that horrible door to the bank. Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just all of that, what are all the things that we can all do to make life feel a bit more like a village in where we are, so there's less of that morbid question about that comes out of being abandoned and alone.
That's so beautiful. Robin, I'm really curious about if you have any thoughts or feelings about risk-taking, allowing risk for kids, giving them opportunities for risk.
Comes up a lot.
Yeah. We're pretty...
We're probably on the looser spectrum.
Just think it feels safer to let them learn how to... For example, feels safer to let Minnow learn how to fall than not know how to fall. We didn't want to get a trampoline with a cage around it because we wanted... Well, we got a secondhand one and it didn't have one, so that's actually not a great example. But I feel more confident knowing that he's going to find his own boundaries and learn how to manage his own body in space and learn what it feels like to fall off a trampoline. And that's maybe the best way to learn how to fall is to do it and to learn how to move your body in space. And I don't know. I'm rambling now.
Yeah, I mean, that's... I don't know that I could add anything to what you've just said. And why is that question being asked so much? And it really feels like there's an incredible shared sense at the moment that we're thirsty for risk opportunities for our kids because it's been removed. There's a sanitization and safety that is actually counterproductive and incredibly disempowering. And, you know, nobody can learn to be self-responsible without the risk of being given responsibility. And, you know, you can err on both sides of that. You can be reckless and give a level of danger that's really about abandonment.
Yeah.
Or you can be neurotic as a community or a school or whatever. And that's a really judgmental word, isn't it? Tells you where I'm coming from. But, you know, hyper alert in a way that the protection suffocates and disempowers the child. So, I get that. And, you know, to me, that's one of those things is where's the right level of risk? Okay, 17.5 is the exact index of risk that's good for the... I don't know. We, you know, we've been left on this planet to figure it out by getting hurt sometimes.
Yeah. I guess the sort of meta question is what happens to us when we aren't given the opportunity to take risks? What kind of adults do we become if we don't dare when we're children?
I think something dies.
Yeah.
Comfortable flatness.
No, that's just the saddest two words together.
Yes, it is. Yes,
you're just thinking of the ocean.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of no waves in the ocean. No, comfortable flatness. Yeah. That too, but yeah.
Comfortable flatness. I was thinking about, I used to be really inspired by the, I don't know, way off topic, but I promise you I'll circle back.
No worries.
The American Bill of Rights is just such a heroic document, you know, the pursuit of happiness. And that back then, the right for an individual to pursue happiness was surely an immense revolution in human consciousness. And we've been living off of that, not just in the States, but around the world. It's a source of great inspiration. Now I'm thinking, pursuit of happiness is such a small, modest thing to ask for. But we also need moments of thrill. And that's beyond happiness. We need moments of thrill. We need moments of ecstasy, joy, bliss, and the freedom to take the risks to get hurt, be disappointed, fail a lot, but have those moments because we feed off of those moments. And happiness is sort of a low-level...
entry point, hey?
Yeah, it is. It's, it's the shallow end of the pool of what we're built to be able to hold in our body. Yeah. I'm not saying by that no one's going to be ecstatic all the time. You shouldn't be, you won't be, it's never going to happen. It's not that. But in thrill, the moment of thrill comes because you just took a risk and you got scared and something happened. It's not just that you didn't die. I mean, maybe, but that And if you're, as we consider that, you're probably thinking of that wave that you thought, am I going to get on that? No, wait a sec. Yes, no. Yes, no, I can't believe it. Oh, no, I'm doing this. And, no, pull back. No, I'm going to go for it. You know, that moment of choice that takes place in probably a nanosecond where you, no, yes. But there's fear and the aggression of seizing a moment that's bigger than you are. The thrill that's produced, that you're going to live off of that thrill for a long time. People will get sick of you telling that story, you know, around the campfire.
Don't look at me like that. But don't we want that?
You become a better person with
children. And don't you love that when you see that in a child?
Yeah.
Ride that bike down the hill and stack it and get back up and go through what they go through, get back on it, and that look when they feel alive. They might not make the ride down the hill, but they do it. And just seeing that.
And your chest swells beyond your ribcage when you see that in your child.
Yeah.
And if there wasn't a risk, that wasn't going to happen. And we learn from that. We learn valuable things. 10 years later, you're realizing one more realization that came out of that moment. So what do I think of risk? What does that sound like? Because, you know, it sounds
essential.
Like that. Yeah. It needs to be part of the curriculum.
Yeah, definitely.
Robin, you wrote, I'm going to quote you to yourself because you write so beautifully. Once we fully comprehend the far-reaching implication of our collective parenting choices, the idea that a mother or father in the home are of lesser status than an executive in the boardroom will be dumped in the deepest corner of the trash bin of history. Parents and teachers can be the most powerful and effective social change agents as long as they are given the resources and social support they need to fulfill their potential. Peaceful and prosperous communities, societies, and nations are wholly possible when children's well-being is made a top priority. That's just so empowering and powerful. And maybe to start to close, I was wondering if you could speak to things that we could be doing more of and maybe some things we could be doing less of as parents to allow our children to flourish and thrive.
Well, first of all, what you just read back to me, I still believe every word of it. And I wrote that a long time ago. It still feels like pretty central. Yeah, we haven't realized the value of parents and elders, really, in our symptomatic civilization.
It's putting power in everyone's hands. It's so empowering.
We're recognizing the immense power that we actually have, the ripples that come from interactions that you consider mundane but have a profound ripple effect. So we're all kind of parenting the future, really. Via the, you know, children aren't islands. They will have friends and co-workers and a village that they give to children of their own. So it kind of makes sense in a fractal sort of a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what can we do differently was your question?
What can we do more of or what can we do less of to allow our children, the children we interact with, to flourish?
I'm just thinking of the one central word for that, which is connection, the thing that helps us to feel more connected. If let's just play a game for a moment or treat it like an experiment of let's make connection our north as a sort of a guiding direction, and then we'll fall off that. You know, sometimes you go left, sometimes you go right or up or down, but keep, you know, the thing to reorient. Is this helping me to feel more connected right now? And more connection to ourselves means listening internally. What gives me my state of flow? How can I build the space that opportunity comes? How can I give myself the soil that I grow in that I'm in my flow states a little bit more often or a lot more often and for longer? And then that's the starting point, connection to self. Equally, like it's a dance, connection to self, connection to each other. connection to the non-human world. What are the kinds of interactions that help my child and I feel more connected to one another? Invariably, that's going to mean more listening. It's not just what we say to our children. More listening, more curiosity about their inner world creates a sense of connection. We are wired for empathic connection. So the way that we show each other our emotional state, there's no value in it where anger is bad and jealousy is bad and joy is good. No color of the rainbow sits above another. So the way that we tell each other the truth of how we feel is a strong connection moment. You feel it. We feel close to one another through the communication of emotion. To me, that's a north. When I feel disconnected from someone in my family, it's time. I've been holding something back. I've been hurt. I've been disappointed. I've been angry. I need to give that some kind of an appropriate voice. Or I need to ask, hey, have you been feeling? Or what's been going on for you? The talking stick moments. That makes, it doesn't just make peace. It makes the space effervescent and alive. The heart opens. You feel it in your chest. And you notice I'm not saying much about how to change the child's behavior. We can come to that at another time. But this is what, when connection, when we know how to find connection every time that we lose it, connection with each other and with ourselves and with nature, other things fall into place from that. Then if you want to learn how to be more assertive or set better boundaries and all of that stuff, the learning is easier. Your impulses flow better when we find connectedness. So in the time that we have in this conversation, that's the one thing I want to say. Connection is the north. Play with that idea.
Special thanks to Patagonia for making this episode possible. They're a certified B Corporation and founding member of 1% for the Planet. Thanks also to our sound engineer and musician, Shannon Saul Carroll. On behalf of myself, Lauren Hill, and my co-host, Dave Rastovich, thanks for listening with us today. We'll be continuing our conversation on Instagram, where we're at Water People Podcast.